Bulletproof Radio, a state of high performance.
You're listening to Bulletproof Radio with Dave Asprey. Now, today's guest is a renowned microbiologist who has researched, studied, and written about Alzheimer's disease for almost four decades. He's discovered several Alzheimer's disease genes, including all three early onset familial genes, and he's worked on developing therapies for Alzheimer's using mini brain organoid models of the disease. And if that's not enough, in his spare time, he plays keyboards for guitarist Joe Perry of Aerosmith, amongst others. In fact, he's been called the rock star of science. I'm talking about none other than Dr. Rudy Tanzi. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here. Wonderful.
You do something I've always wanted to ask people about, and I never understand what this means in academia. So you're a professor of neurology at Harvard and simultaneously like a vice chair of neurology, and you're a co-director at Mass General. And so how can you be the professor of this and master of all that is at multiple places all at the same time? How does that work?
Well, my academic appointment at Harvard Medical School is professor of neurology, and I hold what's called the Kennedy Chair. So the Kennedy family made a chair for their parents, Joseph P. Joseph Kennedy. But at Mass General, mainly what I do is run a large research unit of several labs, including my own, all doing Alzheimer's and brain health research. And then as things go, they ask you to take on administrative jobs. So vice chair of neurology department at Mass General, co-director of the McCants Center for Brain Health, co-director of the Mass General Institute for Neurodegeneration. And although that sounds like way too much, most of those administration jobs are mainly helping people to stay afloat and putting out fires. So most of the hard work goes into the actual research I do. So it's mostly helping people. You know, it's helping people to survive the rigors of academic science.
Okay, thank you for answering that, because I've always kind of wondered when you see someone who has this list of credentials that's incredibly long, but you've been involved with something like more than 600 papers, and I would consider you one of the top names who's been studying Alzheimer's for a very long time. And the reason I wanted to have you on the show is that you've kind of shifted your mindset from what we've believed for a lot of the last 35 years about what's going on. So tell me, what's changed in your perspective on Alzheimer's around beta amyloid and what we all thought was causing it? What's new?
Well, I would say that I've had to adjust my mindset. You know, the first genes I found back in the 80s and 90s all said amyloid, right? The amyloid plaques cause the disease. And that doesn't go away. Those genes still cause a very severe form of Alzheimer's, and four different genes, three of which we found, at Mass General Harvard, all say amyloid deposition in the brain is what starts the disease. So everybody for decades has said, let's stop the amyloid, we'll stop the disease, right? It's kind of like, think about cholesterol and heart disease, right? That was pretty controversial in the beginning, that cholesterol, no one believed cholesterol would cause heart disease. But now, what do we know now? If you have congestive heart failure or a heart attack, imagine your doctor says, here, just take a statin, just take a Lipitor and go home. Well, your heart's not going to get better. Mm-hmm. The cholesterol started the disease off decades before, and then you get to the point of clogged arteries and arteries in the heart that are clogged, and now you have congestive heart failure. It's too late just to take Lipitor. You would take it anyway, but you have to fix the heart. Well, what we've learned is the same thing in Alzheimer's. The amyloid comes really early. It comes decades before the dementia comes, and it builds up, and we've learned that the amyloid then causes nerve cells to die by evoking these things called tangles, these twisted filaments that kill the nerve cells from within. And guess what? Now we've learned that's not even enough to give you dementia. That just kills some cells, but the next step is now as those cells die, because the amyloid caused the tangles, and the tangles are spreading and killing little pockets of nerve cells, not enough to give you dementia, that then has to trigger a very primitive innate immune response in the brain. So the brain has the immune system equivalent of an oyster or a horseshoe crab. It's immunoprivileged. It doesn't want antibodies or T cells or B cells or everything else the body does that's very clever. Brain says, We don't want to risk anybody coming in here. We have a blood-brain barrier. We take care of ourselves. So they have these little cells called glial cells, and they're normally housekeeping and nurturing and helping the nerve cells. But when they smell some cell death, they are programmed the same way they were 50,000 years ago when we were running around in the jungle and our lifespan was 25 years old. And at 20 years old in the jungle, 50,000 years ago, if nerve cells were dying, you had an infection. You got bitten by a bad mosquito. And those glial cells said, this part of the brain's infected. Wipe it out. And guess what? The brain never got the memo about how we live today. That same evolutionary program is in place. We have evolutionary baggage. So you have plaques that come really early and tangles, and you kill a few nerve cells, and the brain's immune system freaks out and says, we're in trouble, wipe it out. And that is what kills enough nerve cells to get Alzheimer's disease. It took 40 years to learn this, but that's science. You learn from your mistakes. The key is you learn, you adapt, you move on. And we're doing that right now really well.
So it feels kind of like the plaque in your arteries is a Band-Aid for damage to the arteries, and the tangles or the plaques in the brain are there because something caused inflammation, and then you get these sort of Band-Aids, and then you get a follow-on effect from the body. Is that a good way of looking at it from a layperson's perspective?
Well, it's a little different, you know, okay. And it's a good analogy, but it needs some nuance, right?
Yeah.
So with heart disease, you know, inflammation can cause plaque, but just high cholesterol can cause plaque, right?
Well, depending on which kind of cholesterol, it could cause plaque, right?
Well, a high LDL, high, you know, what we call bad cholesterol.
Small particle LDL, yeah.
Yeah, right, small particle LDL. But, you know, in Alzheimer's, when you get enough of this amyloid beta protein, and what I found the first Alzheimer's gene back when I was a student at Harvard, and it makes the gene, it's the gene that makes that amyloid beta protein. I called it amyloid protein precursor, a really boring name, APP. And that stuff is being made in the brain. We now think it's made in the brain for a reason. We can get into that. We think it's actually protecting the brain against infections.
Yeah, yeah.
But put that aside for a minute. As this amyloid PEP protein accumulates, it's sticky and it does form plaques and it aggregates. And as that stuff aggregates, we now know that that causes the tangles made up of a different protein called tau. And now nerve cells start dying. But the inflammation that kills the bulk of the nerve cells, removes the bulk of the synapses that causes dementia, comes after that process. Whereas in heart disease, you get kind of more of a juxtaposition, as you were saying, of cholesterol deposition, plaque, and inflammation all around the same time. It's a little bit more iterative in the brain, where you go from plaque to tangle to cell death, trigger neuroinflammation. Now you get the big forest fire that kills enough nerve cells to cause dementia.
So I wrote an anti-aging book that came out recently called Superhuman, hit the New York Times list for a couple of weeks. And I went through this idea of plaques, amyloid basically, throughout the body. It's not just in the brain, there are different types, not necessarily amyloid beta. And it seems like there's a bunch of common elements that can create amyloid, which is one of the big seven pillars of aging in all tissues. Are brain amyloids that different from the amyloids that make all of us age?
It's a different protein, right? I mean, what the one thing they have in common is that there are some amyloids in the body outside the brain that are from proteins that normally try to protect you against microbes.
Mm-hmm.
So they're called antimicrobial peptides. There's lactoferrin, for example, and seminogalin. And these things, when they get overly exuberant in their job of clumping around microbes and trapping them in goo, called extracellular traps, they can cause amyloidosis of the heart, of the eye, etc. In the brain, amyloid beta protein, as my late colleague Rob Moyer and I found, is the main antimicrobial peptide of the brain. And when it encounters a bacteria, it starts to glob around it and form a plaque. We showed that a plaque can form overnight just due to one single bacterium in one of our papers.
Wow.
But you can also have genetics, gene mutations, like the early onset genes, that allow you to make this plaque all the time without the need for a microbe to seed it or nucleate it or you know, trigger it. So every amyloid's a little different, starting with the protein that makes it and how it's triggered. But in the thing about the brain is that, you know, genetics can allow you to accumulate this amyloid over time without the need for a microbe. Just like there are genetic forms of amyloidosis in the kidney, the spleen, the heart, the eye, the seminal vesicles that allow you to make amyloid without any provocation except a difference in the protein from the gene from a mutation.
Does this mean that anything that reduces inflammation might be good for Alzheimer's?
Only if it reduces brain inflammation, which is very, again, very different than body inflammation. So if you try ibuprofen or NSAIDs and steroids, they have very limited ability to stop neuroinflammation in the brain, because neuroinflammation in the brain is the only thing the brain has to protect itself. So it's very different. So in the brain, you literally have these microglial cells, and glia is Greek for glue. They used to think they just glued the nerve cells together, so they said glia is glue. But these little cells are normally housekeeping. And when mm-hmm. you're in deep sleep, getting back to circadian rhythms, when you're in deep sleep, after REM, these little microglial cells go around like scrubby bubbles and clean up the amyloid and all the deposited debris.
Right.
And then literally the brain squeezes it out. It actually constricts and squeezes this crap out through the lymphatic system.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So that's why you need to get enough sleep, because I call it mental floss. It's when you're cleaning your brain.
I like
that. So now, meanwhile, if nerve cells start dying, these same little scrubby bubble microglial cells they're sentinels, and they have ways to detect that nerve cells are dying, just like they did 50,000 years ago. And when they sense a certain amount of cell death, let's say due to plaques and tangles, which are the initiating pathology of Alzheimer's, the pathology that comes very early before mm-hmm. symptoms, they freak out and they say, wipe out the area, wipe it out, we're under attack. They assume the same thing that they assumed 50,000 years ago. If nerve cells are dying, there must be an infection. Well, guess what? At 70 or 80 years old, you could have nerve cells dying because you accumulated enough plaques and tangles to kill enough. And it's an unnecessary innate immune response.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to learn what activates these cells to switch from housekeeper to killer. And my lab found the first gene that does that. Back in 2008, we found the first Alzheimer's gene called CD33. We didn't know what it was at the time. It was actually kind of funny because Time Magazine made it a Time Medical Breakthrough of the Year. And we said, if they only knew, we have no idea what this gene is. And it took us like 5 years to figure out that the CD33 gene is the on switch that tells the microglial cells, stop housekeeping and start killing. So now a lot of companies, and what we're doing is we're trying to turn that gene or turn that protein off as a way to stop neuroinflammation. That's just one way we're trying to do it.
Now, neuroinflammation, you said it's different than bodily inflammation. But aren't the inflammatory molecules called cytokines that run throughout the body? Aren't they kind of the same? Like the ones that are known for causing inflammation in the body, IL-1, IL-6, tumor necrosis factor. There's herbs, there's dietary things, there's ketosis, there's fasting. They seem to lower them in the body, but don't they also lower the same ones in the brain? Or are these ones that don't get into the brain?
You're right. The cytokines are the same. These microglial cells, when they turn into killers, they spit out these cytokines, just like in the body, the macrophages do that. Right? Mm-hmm. The microglia is like the macrophage of the brain. And when they spit out these cytokines, what that does is it invites the other glial cell in the brain, the astrocyte, to the party. So the astrocytes that are doing different jobs that are also helpful get turned on by these cytokines that the killer microglial cells are spitting out, and it makes the astrocytes become reactive. Then the astrocytes gang up with the microglia and just go on a killing spree, eating synapses, eating axons, and killing neurons.
Mm.
So now the microglial cells get the astrocytes to help wipe out that brain area that they think is infected because some nerve cells died, and they do it together. The cytokines get released to do that. Just like in the body, the macrophages, when they release those same cytokines, cause an even greater inflammation response, so to start taking out a tissue.
So for people listening, we don't want our parents to get Alzheimer's, or we don't want to get it ourselves. I'm planning to live way longer than I'm supposed to, and I'd like to remember my name when I'm old. So, I mean, What are the things that you would look at doing as someone who studied this foe for 40 years, knowing that we don't know how to stop Alzheimer's, but if you had to make a bet as to the behavior things that are going to be good, I'm guessing exercise and sleep might be on your list. Are there any other things that you know what? We don't know for sure, but I have a gut feeling after 40 years. I bet you that's better than doing nothing. You got anything for me?
You know what? The answers are not surprising, right? I mean, so I wrote this book with Deepak Chopra a couple years ago.
It was just on the show, by the way. It's cool. Yeah.
Oh, great. So at the end of the Healing Health Self, we had the 7-day action plan for reducing inflammation in your brain and body. And this is a weird story, but around the same time the book was coming out, I had a new album coming out with Joe Perry and Johnny Depp.
I love that.
And Zach Starkey, the drummer from The Who, Ringo Starr's
son. Wow.
And they were having a little record release thing, and I had rehearsals. And I'm thinking, I got to also do this book thing, talk with Deepak and a couple of others. And I'm saying, how can I quickly summarize the 7-day action plan in the book? And I was literally in the shower, and I keep this thing called, I think it's called shower notes or whatever. But it's a pad you can write on in the water, and the little pencil says on it, don't let those good ideas go down the drain.
Oh, nice.
Because you know, like when you're in the shower and like the water's hitting your head, you kind of get into a theta rhythm, meditative rhythm.
Yeah.
You have all these great, you get all these great ideas, and then you like get out of the shower and you're like, oh man, what the heck was I thinking about? And it's all gone away, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote down SHIELD as the acronym.
Okay.
And it was S was for sleep, because you got to sleep 8 hours to get the brain to clean itself enough.
Glymphatic system.
H is handle stress, because stress causes cortisol. Cortisol can kill just enough nerve cells to then trigger neuroinflammation, just like the plaques and tangles do. I is interaction, staying socially engaged. Loneliness is a risk factor for Alzheimer's. Not being alone, but being alone and not liking it, which is loneliness.
Right.
Exercise. We published a big paper in Science a year or so ago showing that exercise induces the birth of new nerve cells in the part of the brain that's affected by Alzheimer's. And we could make Alzheimer's mice better by getting new nerve cells to be born with exercise. And we actually were able to mimic that with two different drugs. Now we can mimic it with two different supplements.
This was via BDNF and NGF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor and nerve growth factor, or is it something else?
You're right. It was BDNF together with a drug that just triggered neurogenesis. Well,
okay.
So in other words, if you just triggered the birth of new nerve cells called neurogenesis, it wasn't enough because they would die.
Yeah.
So you had to give the BDNF at the same time. It's kind of like growing tomatoes in an urban battle zone. You know, you got to add some Miracle-Gro to finish to survive. So you cause the new nerve cells to be born, but there's inflammation and there's crap going on. And you add the BDNF, and it's like Miracle-Gro, and they can survive and then help. So you need both. So that's the E, exercise. And then L is learn new things. So, you know, the bottom line is Alzheimer's, the degree of Alzheimer's correlates with loss of synapses. So you have 100 billion nerve cells, you got, you know, tens of trillions of synapses. And the more you learn new things, the more synapses you make, the more you can lose before you lose it. So I tell people, you're going to retire, don't just think about financial reserve, think about synaptic reserve. If our listeners are learning new things right now, we're helping them. If I'm putting them to sleep, I'm still helping them. So either way, we win. D is diet. So diet is really Mediterranean diet. The Mediterranean diet, plant fiber, less red meat. I'm a vegetarian. I haven't had red meat since college, or fish or chicken. But more plant fiber, olive oil. And you got to help your gut microbiome, because your gut microbiome keeps your brain healthy. You can literally, we published papers showing we could dramatically reduce plaque and neuroinflammation in the brain by having a healthy gut microbiome. And a lot of people take probiotics, which are fine, but you really need prebiotics. You need plant fiber to keep those bacteria in your gut healthy and happy.
I take about 40 to 60 grams a day of specific plant fibers I formulated as a part of Bulletproof, plus all the vegetables that are the foundation of my diet. But
I'd love to learn what those are, because I just take a very simple fructooligosaccharide, which I'm sure doesn't do much.
It's called Inner Fuel, and it's a mixture of acacia gum, which will outperform FOS on studies, though FOS is good.
Wow.
FOS comes from inulin, but if you take very much inulin, you fart like no one's business. We use inulin from chicory in the Bulletproof Collagen bars for a reason. It's a prebiotic, but So in inner fuel, we've got acacia gum, we've got larch arabinogalactin, which is another sap of a tree that, and these are ones shown in studies to feed the good bacteria, not just feed any bacteria in the gut. And then the third thing is hydrolyzed guar gum, which is another plant fiber, but it's hydrolyzed, which means we break it down with enzymes before you get it. So it goes in and feeds the bacteria. And it's, you know, 35 calories. You put two big scoops of it in your coffee, and that gets you about, I think, 2/3 of the RDA for fiber. I've made it because I couldn't, you can't eat enough plants when you travel. You order a plate of vegetables, you get 3 spears of asparagus, and it makes you mad. So the answer for that was I just put that in my coffee. I'm okay.
I would love to learn.
I will send it to you if you want something. Happy to.
That's great. I have to say, I do take the FOS, but I'm not going to admit to having any flatulence problems.
You know, that's why working with anesthetized patients is a good idea when you're a doctor, because then it doesn't matter, right? I'm kidding.
Yeah.
But the idea of managing your gut bacteria is it's just emerging so much with inflammation in the brain. And you can actually see when butyric acid goes up in the gut, which is what the good guys make, that at least according to 2 studies I could find, inflammation in the brain goes down directly, like the inflammatory cytokines we talked about before. So we can't say that prevents Alzheimer's disease, but lowering inflammation in the brain seems like a good idea generally to me, and for all sorts of performance reasons, and probably is protective. True statement? Maybe true. What's your take on that?
Very true. In fact, let me tell you some exciting news. I started a company with 2 young guys, Justin Klee and Josh Cohen, about 6 years ago. They were actually undergraduates at Brown University when I met them. And so they had this idea that to protect against neuroinflammation, right? How does neuroinflammation kill a nerve cell? It's by depleting its energy, right? Oxidative stress.
Oh, yeah.
So they said, if you're going to have a bulletproof vest, right, then you have to protect both the mitochondria, the energy center, and the endoplasmic reticulum, or the ER, where proteins are made.
Exactly.
From what they could find, no one did a trial where you protected both, and they argued you only have half of a bulletproof vest. So we used a taurine analog, TUDCA, for one, and we used, as you were saying, butyric acid. We used phenylbutyric acid for the other side, and you combine them, and it was amazing. Like when we did studies in putting nerve cells in a dish and you add hydrogen peroxide to kill them, these two together save 90%, 95% of the nerve cells. It was unheard of. I thought it had to be an accident, a fluke. So fast forward now to this past year, the company we started is called Amylyx. For transparency, I'm a shareholder because I'm one of the founders of it.
Thank you for exposing that. A-M-I-L-E-X?
A-M-Y-L-Y-X. Amylyx. Mm-hmm. And so they did a trial, these 2 bright young guys, they're 28 years old now, did a trial in ALS. So this is full-blown Lou Gehrig's disease.
Yeah.
6-month trial, 130 or so patients, and they used that combination, and the trial worked. They announced a successful trial back in December. In fact, the ice bucket challenge of ALS, the Pete Frates, who started that, was able to learn 2 days before he died that this trial worked. The ice bucket funded a lot of the actual clinical trial. And this drug worked so well in the trial, it's going to be announced at the AAN meeting, American Academy of Neurology meeting in Toronto in April.
That gives me goosebumps, man.
He gets to learn that 2 days before he passed.
Yeah.
That there may very well be this year, if things go well, a new approved drug for ALS based on the work of these 2 bright kids, you know, that helped out. And they're not kids anymore. But, you know, it just shows if you just protect this isn't even stopping neuroinflammation. It's just protecting the nerve cells in advanced ALS patients against neuroinflammation. And they got a significant difference between the drug and the placebo for rate of disease.
And if you look at the number of brain conditions that are tied to neuroinflammation, you've got autism, ADHD, pretty much Parkinson's, some Alzheimer's. It's a long list. I did a whole book on brain, mostly about mitochondria, but brain energetics and all that. And it's interesting because this idea of adding a phenyl molecule, phenylbutyrate, phenyl makes stuff long-lived in the body, but it's relatively simple. There's something called phenyl GABA, which I'm a huge fan of for sleep, except that it keeps getting sort of gray zoned by the FDA, which is just GABA, a neurotransmitter for calming the brain. You add a phenyl to it so it doesn't break down, and people go to sleep really well on it, but they get addicted if they take a lot of it, apparently. But the idea of going through and finding a relatively simple way of I'm going to call it hacking the brain that your two colleagues figured out. They just thought about systems biology, said, what if we did this? This isn't like a new molecule that came from a spider they found in South America. This is just the, how should it work? What if we tried this? So kudos to them. And that's the sort of thing where I'd say, I wonder if I should just take that on occasion to make my brain live longer. But I'm sure trials will come out for that later, right?
Well, we got an Alzheimer's trial going now.
Okay.
And but you know, the thing is that it was amazing to me to find out that people had done trials trying to protect mitochondria, but no one ever tried to protect where the proteins can get, you know, misfolded at the same time in the ER. And so, you know, here's this combination, and then you know, it worked. And now, so I have another company I'm helping out as the head of their SAB, again, shareholder, called AZ Therapies, where we use the Alzheimer's brain in a dish model you talked about earlier, the mini brain organoids. And we just, you know, now that we have these mini brain organoids the size of paper punches, we can screen any drug, natural product 100 times faster, 100 times cheaper than when we had to use mice. And actually, it's a much better model than mice. I mean, mice kind of suck as a model for the brain. We like to say in my lab that mice are like Vegas. What happens to mice stays in mice. And it doesn't read them.
I've never heard that. I like that.
So we use these brain organoids. But we just, one of the drugs, it's an asthma drug called Cromolyn, you know, is able to take the microglial cells and keep them from being killers and keep them in that housekeeping state. So it stopped the neuroinflammation. So with this company, we worked out a way to get Cromolyn. Like if you just take regular Cromolyn for asthma, it won't get into the brain. But it was reformulated and delivered in a way that does get into the brain.
What, nasal spray liposome or something?
No, it's just a micronized, highly micronized powder Cromolyn with an inhaler that gets it into the deep lung. Cool. So now the Cromolyn can be transferred into the blood through the alveoli and into the brain. So that trial is an Alzheimer's. It's a phase 3 trial. It's going to read out later this year. And they're also doing an ALS trial. So that's the other side of the coin. Take out the sniper. In other words, the Amylyx kids gave the bulletproof vest. That worked. The other company is trying to take out the sniper, take the microglial cell killer and turn it back into a housekeeper. Imagine if you had both together, if they both work. Basically, you could treat Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, ALS, depression, autism, just like you were saying.
20 years from now, are we going to be looking back and saying, man, that was the dark ages. People's brains just kept screwing up all over the place as they aged. And now like, we just know how to do it.
Hey there, ice bath lovers. Do you want to take your cold exposure game up a notch with some contrast therapy? Well, you should, because cold plunges and contrast therapy can lower stress, up your immunity, and even help you sleep better. It works better than just cold therapy alone. Well, now you can do that with the new Michael Phelps Chili Goat Cold Tubs by Master Spas. Whether you want to relax in a hot soak or get energized with a cold plunge, the Michael Phelps Chili Goat Cold Tub has you covered. You can easily hop out of the hot water, get in the cold water, and go back and forth. When you do that, you get better results in less time, and that's what biohacking is all about. Go to chiligoattubs.com, use promo code DAVE500, and you can save $500 on any Chili Goat cold tub. I have one in my backyard. That's chiligoattubs.com, promo code DAVE500.
Absolutely.
Oh, that makes me so happy. I think so, too.
It's been a learning curve. I mean, you know, I was involved with the first ever genetic studies to find a disease gene back when I was 20 years old with Jim Gasella. He was 25. We found the Huntington's disease gene. We found the first 5 genetic markers in the genome, got ridiculously lucky with just a handful of genetic markers where the gene could be anywhere. We found it, you know, with 20,000 to 1 odds against. And that study kind of triggered the Human Genome Project. And I do hope Jim Gasella, it was all his idea, will get the Nobel Prize for that someday. It was the first time a disease gene was found by genetics. But and then I switched over to Alzheimer's after that and found the first Alzheimer's gene. But I think about it, you know, we've only been finding these genes for these mysterious diseases for a few decades. Here's how it worked. The first genes you find are the really extreme cases, early onset, familial. So they tell you about the earliest events that happen. They're now happening even earlier, like you're born 2 years old, you're already having these events happen. Normally, they don't start till 30 or 40. So then you try to treat those events in a patient, and it's too late. You're trying to put out a forest fire by blowing out the match. The forest fire is neuroinflammation. These early genes taught us about the triggers, the matches, the brush fires. It's too late to stamp those out. But now all the newest Alzheimer's genes we're finding, like over a dozen of them, tell us how to stop neuroinflammation. And one of them was this first gene we found, CD33. And now you're seeing the drugs come out. You know, you got the trial from Amylyx, you got a new trial. You're going to see that just like glory days coming up for brain disease in the next few years.
There's two things I've researched a lot and written about and talked about that have studies specifically for Alzheimer's that were positive. One of them was MCT oil, and the other one was nicotine, not smoking. Smoking is clearly going to cause inflammation from burning stuff and breathing it. But nicotine itself, Paul Newhouse's work at Vanderbilt since 1988, and these are both bioenergetics, right? You're basically giving the mitochondria more energy via sticking to different receptors or just giving it a different fuel source with more electrons. Any validity in your experience on stacking those approaches with the new drugs or with the SHIELD protocol that you talked about?
Yeah, I can't see the harm in it. I mean, why not? I mean, I don't think giving an alternative energy source is going to save, in other words, it's not going to stop the disease or cure it. But, you know, if the problem in the end of the day is that neuroinflammation is depleting nerve cells of energy, and, you know, and now you're given an alternative energy source, like, you know, anaerobic energy source, why not? You know, why not do that for the patient? But I think if so I would say stack it for sure. But I don't want people to say that, you know, MCTs or virgin coconut oil is a cure.
Yeah, virgin coconut oil doesn't do very much compared to, it's the same as 8 hours of fasting, like basically sleeping overnight. So coconut oil, no. There was a phase two clinical trial on one of the types of MCTs that had really good results that was reversing. But it's just one study, right? And so I don't know that that's a protectable IP thing. But it feels like maybe there or even just any kind of ketogenic diet, because when you get the ketones in, the mitochondria perform better, and a mitochondria that doesn't leak electrons doesn't create inflammation. And that was the model. So the approach that I've been advocating is do everything that reduces inflammation in the brain, which includes having high functioning mitochondria at the same time, you know, you eat less stuff like bad fats and sugar and all that.
Yeah.
And you stop pissing off your immune system with inflammatory proteins, if you know what they are, stuff like that. And basically you ought to live longer or at least function longer without getting bad stuff, whatever the list of bad stuff is. But I wonder if there's more there. And what about nicotine? Like, that's so controversial. You may not be able to say anything, but what's your take there?
No, nicotine, I actually take nicotine in my riboside.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, me too.
NR.
And NAD,
it's a precursor of NAD. It boosts ATP levels. It boosts energy.
Yeah.
In our hands, it also induces neurogenesis. In fact, nicotinamide riboside induces neurogenesis better than the drugs we were using, the chemicals we were using in our science paper.
Yeah.
And now we're trying to find additional supplements that can induce BDNF, because if you induce neurogenesis and BDNF, then you can mimic the effects of exercise. Not that you take exercise away, but at least the beneficial effects of exercise for the brain.
Right.
Right. So we now found like theamine, coffee fruit extract, cat's claw extract. All of these things induce BDNF.
The first shipping coffee fruit extract that was specifically for raising BDNF was a bulletproof product. It's still out there called Neuromaster. So I'm like, this raises BDNF four times more than exercise. Maybe you should take this and then do some squats. like you might as well do both.
so we're giving nicotinamide riboside together with coffee fruit extract.
Oh, neat.
To mice, because so we're following up on that science paper saying, how can we help these Alzheimer's mice the way exercise did? And exercise, remember, both induced new nerve cell birth, neurogenesis, mm-hmm. and induced BDNF. So we combine the nicotinamide riboside to induce the neurogenesis, and then we induce the BDNF with either coffee fruit extract or cat's claw is also very good.
Cat's claw is interesting because it's a South American herb that's been used for Lyme disease and toxic mold for a very long time, where you tend to have neurological breakdown. Even the myelin protein that lines your nerves can break down. Full disclosure, I had both of those. I started playing with that a long time ago, but now we understand kind of how it works. And even things like psychedelic mushrooms raise levels of BDNF and nerve growth factor in the brain. I'm not saying that Alzheimer's people should be eating a bunch of red and white mushrooms, but there's interesting studies. I'm like, how do we get more? Any other ideas for how to get more of that besides exercise?
So we're doing it. So basically, so this guy, Alan Roses, another Alzheimer's researcher, and I test this cat's claw that we get out of Peru.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually started a company that sells it as a product called Percepta. It's cat's claw plus oolong tea. And we tested that in Alzheimer's mice, and actually it has anti-amyloid, anti-tangle, anti-neuroinflammatory properties, but it also induces BDNF. So again, I'm an equity holder in that company just for transparency purposes. But you know, when I believe in something, you know, I get behind it. You know, I just get it out to the masses. If you have to start a company, do it. But when you're talking about mushrooms, so yeah. Paul Stamets, who you might know,
he's been on the show. Love him, yeah.
But,
he was sitting Paul Stamets, right here. And
he's now collaborating with us.
Oh, good.
He just sent us 5 extracts. I told him, don't send anything hallucinogenic. I don't want to go to jail. You know,
but lion's mane, though. Are you guys looking at lion's mane?
Well, but we've already been doing lion's mane, and we have some good results there. So he sent us extracts of non-hallucinogenic versions of, I guess, the psilocybin family mushrooms. I don't even know what he sent. I mean, you know, Paul's a mystery wrapped in an enigma. Okay. And so Paul sent me these mushroom extracts, and I said, you know, we'll prepare them, and we're putting them on our Alzheimer's in a dish. We're going to see what they do to plaques, to tangles, to neuroinflammation, and get back to them. But we just started doing that collaboration now. I met him at the Exponential Medicine.
I miss Exponential Medicine because I had to get home to see my kids after the Abundance 360 conference with Peter Diamandis. So I just missed meeting you there. But that idea, and you said something really important there. I get behind the things I believe in. If you have to start a company, go for it. So, man, full respect for that. There's always trolls out there saying, well, you're making money. How dare you say it? Like, look, you want to do something useful in the world, you might want to make it pay for itself. So high five on starting multiple companies or being involved, advising multiple companies, making stuff that you can't buy. That's kind of how the world evolves. So
you can't wait for others to do it for you. Yeah. If you believe in it, you do it, man.
It's a lot easier to sit there on Twitter and yell at the people who do it and then buy their stuff anyway.
Oh, believe me. I've been the victim. You know, I wrote 3 books for Deepak Chopra. Yeah. Between those and the stuff I do, I mean, I don't care about trolls. They can yell all they want. At the end of the day, people are going to remember who helped them.
And not only that, the more they yell, the more they're likely to get a neurodegenerative disease because of the stress part. So you can just feel compassion for them as they yell at you and drain their neurons, right? That was kind of dark.
I actually do feel empathy for them.
Yeah, you have to eventually. Now, okay, so there's a bunch more potential new mushroom stuff. And I respect Paul so much. He's a good human being. So we've got some exercise going on. What about the circadian stuff? Sachin Panda's been on the show. One of my companies, again, full disclosure, I started it because I had to do it. We make glasses that for me and for a lot of people report a doubling of deep sleep when you measure it with a ring or however else you measure it. And it seems like going to bed on time, getting large amounts of deep sleep are important for that. What's your take on circadian timing, fasting, darkness for Alzheimer's and neuroinflammation? Are those things that you can measure with a brain in a dish?
Well, you know, if you think about what sleep is doing for neuroinflammation in particular, is right after REM, during that slow wave sleep, you know, you're consolidating memories. So your dreams are fictionally regurgitating whatever memories were triggered all day. So you can consolidate and reinforce those synapses during the slow wave deep sleep. It's during slow wave deep sleep. It's also the only time you're not making amyloid in your brain, right? Because amyloid's being made in your default mode network that maintains your ego and who you are all day, all the time. Only after REM, during slow wave sleep, does that thing turn off, right? And but thirdly, it's during slow wave sleep that microglial cells go to town and they just start chomping up all that debris and spinning it out and get in the brain to constrict and get it out. It's called the glymphatic system. Glymphatics, when the glial cells eat. Lymphatic systems, when the brain squeezes it out. So you need to get enough of that REM to deep sleep cycling, and you need to get enough sleep for that purpose. Fasting, I fast, you know, several times a week, because I do think inducing an anaerobic metabolism is also good for the body, good for the brain. I don't.
Are you doing MCTs, but. Intermittent fast? You're skipping breakfast basically, or are you doing a longer fast?
So after dinner the night before, I don't have breakfast or lunch.
Okay, so intermittent fast, 18-hour kind of thing.
18 hours, or maybe sometimes longer, and then drink a lot of water all day, and then eat dinner at night.
You already answered my biggest question, which was like, is there hope? You know, in 20 years, are we going to just be done with this? Is 20 years too long? Is this a 5-year problem?
Well, here's how it's going to be. In the next 5 years, we're going to help the patients who have Alzheimer's now by finally giving them what they need. And that means drugs that stop, or supplements, or lifestyle behavioral modifications, all the above, that hit neuroinflammation. It's too late to hit plaques and tangles and people who are suffering from, you know, full-blown Alzheimer's right now. Maybe if you get them in a really early stage, you might be able to hit the plaques and the tangles. But that's what we've learned. We can do that in the next 5 years. I mean, the first drug trial that protects against neuroinflammation, you know, from this company Amylyx I helped start, is already going to be out there, you know, and the next ones are coming. As far as like the what's going to happen, I have an 11-year-old daughter. How is she going to stop Alzheimer's when she's older? She's not going to wait for neuroinflammation to come around and then try to put out the fire. She's going to stop the initial match and brush fires to get you there, meaning she's going to be monitoring her blood tests, whether she's making too much plaque or tangle in her brain. And she's going to start taking, whether it's a natural product or a drug or modifying her lifestyle, she's going to do what she has to do to bring the amyloid plaques down when she's 20 or 30 years old or 40 years old. Just like with heart disease, you know, we manage cholesterol at middle age. You don't wait to get heart disease and say, okay, now I'm going to manage my cholesterol now that I have congestive heart failure. That's going to be the route of entry. So I think for the longer term of early detection of Alzheimer's, early prediction, followed by early intervention, where you stop the initiating pathology way before you get to rampant neuroinflammation, that's stage two. And that's going to take, you know, probably more toward 10 years.
Wow. And I would think, but only 10 years. Like,
10 wow. years, yes, because now we know how to do it. I have a drug I've been developing with a colleague in San Diego for 20 years called a gamma secretase modulator. It's the last drug standing. There will be a small little white pill you can take to bring your amyloid down. All the rest bit the dust because they weren't safe. Ours is, we hope, is going to be safe. It's going into clinical trials. It's predicted based on how it was developed to be safe. And we're hoping that's going to be, if you have to take it, hopefully your lifestyle and everything else you're doing, it would mean you don't have to take it, but just in case, just like you have to take a statin, right? We're going into clinical trials at the end of this year after 20 years of development, $50 million of preclinical development. The trial, the safety trial with my colleague Steve Wagner, will start at the end of this year. So good things take time. And I'm thinking if that drug's going to take some time to get out there, but if that makes it, now you got a blood test that's going to come out of WashU St. Louis in about a year or two. So the future will be you get your blood test at whatever years old, 40 years old. They say, hey, you know, for your plaque in your brain, you're in the like 40th percentile. It wouldn't hurt to take this little white pill to bring your plaque back down. Now, we don't want to wipe out your amyloid beta protein because it helps protect your brain against microbes. We just want to dial it down, just like you would take Lipitor to not wipe out your cholesterol, but dial it down. Mm-hmm. That's future. That's going to take a little bit longer. But the first anti-neuroinflammatory medicines for neurodegenerative disease, neuropsych disease, they've already started. They're going to be out over the next few years.
This was one of the hypotheses, or hypothesi, whatever more than one of those is called.
Hypotheses.
Hypotheses for Superhuman is that there are hundreds and hundreds of researchers who've been working for 2, 3, 4 decades on hacking all of the different pillars of aging, the big diseases, and Alzheimer's disease was one of the big 4 killers. It was the fourth one, but 10% of people are likely to get it if you look at statistics today. And the deal is, how do you not be one of those 10%? But also, it's one of the big things after cancer, heart disease, and diabetes, Alzheimer's ranks. So, but every one of those has their rock stars like you, although not all of them are literally rock stars, but hey, you know. What's going on there is all of it's hitting fruition this decade. And this is why I think we're going to live a lot longer than we think we're going to live, because the big killers are getting taken out, and the root causes around this buildup of amyloid and all of the other things, there's someone working on it. Guys like, you know, your two former kids, you know, now in their mid 20s, but your business partners, hey, they did it, and it didn't take them that long. So I'm more hopeful than I've ever been about our ability to be very healthy, very energetic, and even look good when we're old. Are you there too? I mean, you think that's where we're going?
I'm right there with you. Okay. You're spot on. And I would say on Alzheimer's, think about this. At 85 years old, 40% of our population have at least the early symptoms of Alzheimer's, if not full-blown Alzheimer's, for 85. The current lifespan is 80. A kid 12 years old right now, or even someone 20 mm-hmm. or 30, can't expect to live till 80 or 85. If you do the math there, for people in their 20s or 30s right now, they almost have a 40 or 50% chance of living long enough to get this disease. Because they're probably going to live till 85, at which point, depending on the study you read, have a 40 to 50% chance of having Alzheimer's. On top of that, you're 20 or 30 right now, and you know, you're paying off your college loans and medical school or whatever, graduate school loans, and you finally get free and you have kids and you pay for their college. And then what happens? You finally say, breathing room, and then you got to take care of your parents who are living long enough to get Alzheimer's disease, right? So, I mean, this disease just hits every age group, and a lot of young people don't think about it, but now they have to.
The other thing that's just worth noting, in fact, oh, I got to ask you this. So I was the largest supporter, individual supporter last year of Maria Shriver's Women's Alzheimer's group. And Alzheimer's hits women more because they tend to be in caregiver roles, but they also get Alzheimer's like 50% more often than men. I know that's 2/3 of people who have it are women versus men. Are your little brains in petri dishes? Are they girl brains or boy brains?
Well, that's the thing. So I'll tell you something. So actually today, at a luncheon in New York, my colleague, my geneticist colleague who works with me, is at the Women in Alzheimer's Movement luncheon with Maria Shriver.
With Maria Shriver. I love her. She's so good.
Because they just gave us funding for our study to find genetic risk factors that predispose women different than men. And we already found 4 different genes that increase risk in women but protect men, or vice versa, increase risk in men and protect women, like the exact opposite of men and women.
So are half your brains female brains with the cell cultures doing?
The problem is that we can do that. We have mixed female and male, you know, nerve cells from stem cells, but a lot of it has to do more with hormones and steroid. So because it's hormonal differences, you can't yet replicate that in the dish. Yeah. So I can't really say we're truly addressing male versus female.
You'd
risk
have to,
in the dish
to add testosterone or estrogen to a certain cell along with a treatment and see or something. Wow. Okay. Still.
But wait. I'll tell you something. One of the supplements that's like estrogen, genistein, was among our natural products that had a really strong effect on tangles, actually.
In women or in men?
In the dish.
Oh, in the dish. Yeah. It has problems for humans who take it, from what I've
I'm not saying to take it. I'm just saying it worked in the dish.
It was one of those things. So, yeah, some of those weird plant phytosterols can do cool stuff, but if they're also hormone mimicking, we got to look at the system. Well, I feel like I could talk to you all day, and I'm really grateful you took the time for the interview. And just to help everyone listening, just know we are hacking this. There are guys like Rudy out there who are actively doing the heavy lifting that is showing up for you. So when you say, oh, I should take this, you know, bottle of supplements, there might be 20 years of knowledge or 60 years of knowledge. And the stuff about cat's claw, the shaman who first gave me ayahuasca 25 years ago took me to the market and had me buy cat's claw and told me to take it afterwards because it would help. Okay, he knew something. He couldn't spell BDNF, right? In fact, I don't know if anyone could we not have known about it. But there was ancient knowledge there, but we didn't know why, we didn't know how, we didn't even know whether it was actually safe. But you know, you've gone out, you've looked at that, and there's so much like that. So I'm incredibly inspired, incredibly hopeful, and actually expecting improvements in all of the markers there. And so the audience that's listening today just got to hear, you know, from one of the guys in the trenches. So just my thanks, and on behalf of the
hundreds of thousands of people are going to hear this. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And can I say one last thing? If you're interested in supporting Alzheimer's research, the Cure Alzheimer's Fund is who I work with. It's curealz.org. Cure Alzheimer's Fund's given out over $110 million of research funding, and it's the best top Alzheimer's research in the world. And every dollar they take in is a dollar out. They take no overhead out of your money. So if you give a dollar, it's a dollar out to research. And they're a great foundation, and they've made a lot of these discoveries we talked about today possible. So Cure Alzheimer's Fund.
All right. You guys heard that? If you're inspired by this, or if you have someone in your family who is, you know, who's affected by this, or you just don't want to be yourself and you're saying, I got 20, 30 years, if I have to worry about that. Well, here's the deal. Fund a little bit now. So 30 years from now, you definitely won't have to worry about it. CureAlls.org and the Women's Alzheimer's Movement are both just profoundly good charities. And yes. Going out there and, you know, maybe going for a walk is a good thing to add to your stack as well. So, Rudy, thanks again for your work, for your books with Deepak, and for starting multiple companies that are solving the problems of mankind. And I hope that you make incredible amounts of money from each one of those, because I know what you'll do with it. You'll probably put it back into research.
Absolutely. But right back into a foundation. I've immensely enjoyed our discussion. Thank you so much.
The Human Upgrade, formerly Bulletproof Radio, was created and is hosted by Dave Asprey. The information contained in this podcast is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended for the purposes of diagnosing, treating, curing, or preventing any disease. Before using any products referenced on the podcast, consult with your healthcare provider, carefully read all labels, and heed all directions and cautions that accompany the products. Information found or received through the podcast should not be used in place of a consultation or advice from a healthcare provider. If you suspect you have a medical problem or should you have any healthcare questions, please promptly call or see your healthcare provider. This podcast, including Dave Asprey and the producers, disclaim responsibility for any possible adverse effects from the use of information contained herein. Opinions of guests are their own, and this podcast does not endorse or accept responsibility for statements made by guests. This podcast does not make any representations or warranties about guest qualifications or credibility. This podcast may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products or services. Individuals on this podcast may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to herein. This podcast is owned by Bulletproof Media.